It's time for Intersections, where art and science meet, your weekly hour of conversation, where you learn about curious ideas, creative works, and interesting phenomena with your host, Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, and Krista Hoffman-Longton, Assistant Dean for Faculty Affairs and Professional Development at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Now, it's time for Intersections, where art and science meet.
I'm Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, where we create a museum without walls so artists, scientists, and the community can create unique interactions and conversations. And in today's conversation, we're going to be talking about The Net Makers. It's the fourth film streaming on Hudox. And the kind of the storyline is in rural southern Indiana, two men carry on the tradition of crafting hoop nets, which is going to be something we'll talk about what those are, and commercially fishing in the White and Wabash rivers. Joining us for today's conversation are Hannah Myers Lindgren. Welcome, Hannah.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to talk about this.
Great. And Rocky Walls, who we've had on before, who's the producer and founder of Hudox. Welcome, Rocky.
Hey, thanks. Thanks for having me back.
So this is really exciting, Hannah. But why don't we just start with what people will say, net makers, and the word that I always thought was interesting, hoop nets. Can you describe a little bit just about that so we kind of have a context for that?
Yeah, I think, you know, when I first heard about these net makers that, would make a great film, I pictured, you know, just kind of like a loose fishing net, like I think a lot of other people might picture. But they're actually just really visually interesting nets. I find them very beautiful. And it's basically if you pictured six or seven hula hoops kind of put together with a net and sort of like, like a tunnel, or you know, and then the end of one obviously is closed because that's how you keep the fish in. And then within that sort of tunnel, you have two sort of funnels that help funnel the fish further in so that they can't swim back out. So that's what they kind of look like, and they're massive. I mean, they're, you know, 10 feet long, so or more. So they're very visually interesting and made even, I feel like they were kind of like a character in themselves, like within the film.
Yeah, and so I'm trying to get a side, the diameter, are they as big as a hula hoop or bigger?
Yeah, they can be a little bit smaller and then they can be way bigger. They can be, you know, 6 feet in diameter too.
So, right. Yeah. Are they then hand manipulated in the water?
So
behind a boat.
So they're actually put in the water and are put strategically in various points within the river, depending on where they know the fish that they want to catch will be swimming. Because you know, fish have preferences of whether they like to be in the middle or on the edges or warm water, cold water. So then they put them on the ground and they actually leave them there for, you know, a day or two and then come back and pull it up. And then the fish that have gotten caught in there, you know, they take them out. So, yeah.
So two other geeky things here. One, I assume it's they're weighted so that they stay down there.
I do think that there is a weight, but they're very heavy just in themselves. So
they stay down in the water.
Yeah, because each of the hoops is either made, Danny makes his with metal, and then Larry makes his with resin. So if you imagine, you know, six, seven, eight of those, plus the weight of the netting, you know, and all of the knots in it, in itself is pretty heavy.
Wow. Yeah,
and they tar them. So they're also covered in tar, which adds to the weight as well.
Wow. And then my other geeky kind of question is, I'm assuming that on those funnels, right, they act as one-way valves, right? So what's happening if the fish gets into one and it can't go back?
Exactly. Yeah. They somehow find their way in through that small opening in an attempt to get out when really they're just making themselves more trapped.
Oh my gosh. This is great.
It's like a you know, I've got kids, and I think about the if anybody else, any listeners have kids, they probably have seen or even used for an amusement tool, the tunnels that kids can run through, they pop up, you know, and the kids can like run through them. So it's kind of like a combination of that and those finger traps that mm-hmm. you get stuck in.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
That's kind of what I'm picturing, hearing Hannah describe it for the first time in person, because even though I've seen the film, I've not heard Hannah describe it. Those were like things that occurred to me hearing your descriptions, yeah. Hannah, that never occurred to me watching the film.
I think they're hard to understand if you haven't seen it. And, you know, I have done different view interviews and stuff, and it's like, how do you describe something so distinct? So I've gotten good at it, of like what exactly it looks like. But I definitely, you know, in my head, I think of that, like the kids or like that pets maybe play with, those ones that sit on the ground. So it's very, very similar to that, but on a larger scale.
Yeah.
So we're talking, go ahead, Rocky.
I was going to say, because like I said, that was the first time I had really pictured them that way. Your film, which we'll talk at length about here in the episode, does such an amazing job of showcasing the nets, that's like how I know them now, is from the film. And so seeing the way they're assembled and the care that goes into it, if someone ever said to me hoop nets, I know exactly what they're talking about now, because you did such a good job of really featuring that art in the film, which is really cool. So looking forward to talking more about it. Mark, go ahead. Sorry, I interrupted.
No, that's great. That leads us right into where we wanted to go. And Hannah, so what inspired you? How did you even come upon this as an idea?
Yeah, so it's a funny story, actually. I had already submitted an idea to Indiana Humanities for this Waterways Film Grant, but then I was approached by John Kay from Traditional Arts Indiana and from Indiana University, and he said, hey, I have this really interesting story. I've known these guys for like over a decade. I think this would be, you know, a perfect intersection of, you know, humanities and art and things like that in our waterways as well, and also just our history as a state. And I was like, oh man, Indiana Humanities, can I like apply for, you know, a second time? And so I was able to partner with John in a producer capacity and submit that idea. So yeah, he's worked with them a ton for more than a decade to spread the word about what they do. You know, his thing that he does is celebrate traditional arts, that, you know, methods all around the world, but particularly in Indiana. And so you'll see them, you know, Larry and Danny taking their nets to various classes or presentations or conferences or museums, all these different opportunities to share, you know, what their craft is all about and the history and why it's important to them. So he's already doing that education, which really made it easy for me to just, you know, attach to that narrative that he's already been kind of telling about them, and then say, now, you know, how can we, you know, make this into a film and you know, tell this in that particular kind of way, that particular kind of storytelling that happens with film. So it was really collaborative and great, kind of taking this institutional knowledge that he, you know, brought to the table with them and this whole topic. And then, you know, me coming in not knowing anything about it kind of lent a new perspective to it. I was able to ask them, you know, different questions that he might not have thought of. So it was a really great collaboration.
That's really interesting, Rocky.
Yeah, I think we should talk about real quick the Indiana Humanities component, right? Because I think this is the second round of films that they've helped to fund in Indiana about the waterways. And Mark and I even have experience in talking about and helping to promote, you know, waterway content, whether it's films or other types of experiences and content. And I love the fact that you took this route. I have a question. I'll eventually get to there. But I think it's really cool that there are these films, not only the Netmakers, but even a previous film of yours, but then several others on WhoDocs and out there on the Indiana Humanities website that really showcase our waterways in such a like really broad, diverse way. I think my question for you is, kind of around that, like the Indiana Humanities funds these films around topics like the waterways to bring about conversations and think about or challenge viewers to think about our waterways in maybe a new way or maybe inspire them to care for our waterways in maybe ways that they didn't before. Your film, what I think is really special about it and unique is that while there are points in the film where we touch on change and the health of waterways and the ways that we interact with our waterways. And we're talking about fishing, for example, which is a topic related to not only, you know, our rivers, but our even our oceans, you know, where there's, you know, a lot of opinions about and there are concerns, you know, and but there are also beautiful things and art and tradition associated with it. So I guess what I'm wondering is, as you researched and then of course spent time with the two gentlemen, how did you balance what essentially was a character study on two very interesting artisans with also their craft, the hoop nets, and also the river, which was, you know, a big part of it, right? You had to talk about the river where these nets were going, right? And I'm just curious, like, was there ever push and pull? Did you ever feel like you were like you needed a little more of one or the other? How did all of that marry together? Because I do think you did a wonderful job of balancing it all in this film. I left it feeling like I didn't particularly feel that it was overemphasizing any one of those really key areas. And so I'd just love to hear your thoughts on how you did that.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're totally right. It is a character study, and that's kind of that is my bread and butter. It's like what I love to do is to tell human stories, putting the human in humanities, I guess. And I really felt very attached to the two of them because my grandfather's from Southern Indiana, a little bit further east, but I like saw him in them. So I was able to connect. I've also always loved Southern Indiana. I think it's a beautiful part of our state with these huge rivers and it's hilly and, you know, there's so much, I don't know, land diversity in Southern Indiana. So for me, it was both about being a character study and being like super rooted in place. I knew that, you know, just because I already loved this area, you know, I've always loved New Harmony ever since I learned about its history. And that was one of the locations we were at. I knew that place was going to be a huge part of it, you know, maybe even, you know, a fourth character. So we have the two gentlemen, we have the nets, and we have place. And obviously place is related to the waterways, because down there, you know, the whole reason why there are these communities in Southern Indiana is because there was these huge waterways. It's where all the, you know, economy came from. It's where there was, you know, why there's a workforce needed there. I mean, power is developed there, commerce, you know, there's so much that has happened in Southern Indiana on the waterways. So yeah, I did try to make sure that we were very rooted in place. And while we were focused mainly on the men, we were also focused on how their lives intertwined with the rivers and with this location. And I mean, you just talk to them about what they do and there's no avoiding them talking about the rivers. I mean, not just because that's like where they use their nets, but also every facet of their life, you know, is related to the rivers. There's so much that I learned about like weather and like, cause we, you know, us trying to get out and film on the rivers, you know, just the weather and how that impacts whether they can go out and get their hoops and pull them up and, you know, harvest the fish and stuff like that. So, yeah, I mean, it really just kind of wrapped itself in there without even me trying. It's just such part of the narrative.
You know, it's interesting, Hannah, and you mentioned this earlier and then you mentioned it again, and you obviously have the human element, the two guys, but I'm always interested because as a museum professional in the object. Mm-hmm. And so you talked about place, but you also talked about the net. So how did you make the net have a role in this?
Yeah, it's funny because I actually had to like pull back on how much we focused on the net because I mean, when you sit these guys down and they show you what they're doing, it's so detailed, it's so intricate. And with a short film model, you have, you know, your real estate with your time is so important on like what is going to end up, you know, actually in the film. And so yeah, I really had to, because, you know, I have stuff that's left on the cutting room floor that's like an hour of them explaining to me how they make these nets and like actually like what the knot action is and stuff. And like that just, you know, didn't end up needing to be in there, I don't think, to understand like how intricate they are and how much time they put in there. And, you know, I focused instead on, you know, saying, you know, this has 6,000 knots, and then you're like, oh wow, like, and you see them make one knot, and then you can picture that times, you know, 6,000 and like understand the scale. But yeah, it's funny, I had to kind of pull back on it and more treat the nets just as like, yeah, a thing of beauty and a thing of function. Some of my favorite shots in the film are where like you're looking through the barn doors, and it's kind of, they're silhouetted kind of hanging after he's after Danny's put them through tar and he's letting them dry, you know. And I think it's just such a striking image, and they were always really beautiful to me, these nets. I think not just because, yeah, they're visually beautiful, but also like you just see the hard work that's gone into them. You see these guys' hands and their knotted hands and their hands that have calluses all over them that have been doing this for, you know, 50 years, 60 years. Both of them use these, like wax baths for their hands because their hands hurt so much from having, you know, done this all the time. And you hear Larry talk about, you know, he was watching cartoons when he was like 8 and doing knots. So I think I just saw the beauty in the objects because of this, all the story that surrounded, you know, the nets. But I definitely love them as a character in the film.
Yeah, we're fortunate to have Indiana is fortunate to have such a beautiful film about these artisans. You know, I don't think it's possible to overstate how beautiful the shots are in the film. You know, you weren't just running around with, you know, your iPhone catching something that, you know, was beautiful. I'm not to knock, you know, anybody who's filming something with an iPhone, but you know, the subject was beautiful, but the way that you filmed it was beautiful as well. So just really, really happy to have them.
Yeah. Thanks. I honestly, like, I couldn't have done it without Evelyn Reary, who was my director of photography. It was literally just me and her, and then sometimes John Kay as producer doing all of this. And, you know, it was really a run and gun, like low budget, you know, situation. But just the time we spent with them, you know, we started, we went down 3 times. The first time we went down, we just did the interviews with them. And I think that was a really great opportunity to just get to know them, look at the place, look at these, you know, studios where they're at, and just build that relationship. So then when we could, you know, come back, regroup and say, this is what we think stood out to us visually. So then when we went back a second time, we filmed in each of their studios. We had a studio day with each of them. So we saw them, you know, creating the nets and in their home spaces. And then we came back a third time and went on the river. But yeah, I think she really understood what the vision was and did such an incredible job of collaborating, you know, to, you know, she brought ideas to the table, I brought ideas to the table, and it ended up looking really beautiful. I found just the setting and the art that they did so beautiful that I even brought, I love film photography, so I brought a film photography camera, and I just took pictures, and they're some of my favorite photos I've ever taken, because just the grittiness and the beauty and the nature, like, you know, Danny's house, you know, just kind of tucked in these rolling farmland, you know, of Southern Indiana. It's so beautiful. So yeah, I feel really lucky. And we really lucked out on fantastic weather when we were down there, and just sort of this like May, June, beautiful Indiana weather. So it was great.
Anna, go ahead, Rocky.
I remember seeing this will be quick. I remember seeing some behind the scenes, like photos and video clips, I think, of the two of you on these boats. As they're going. And I do remember thinking, like, wow, That could look a lot different.
Yeah.
it looked like, you know, I don't know. Maybe you were a little nervous here and there, but it looked like, overall you're probably having a really, really good time. And so that's a lot to do with the weather for sure.
Yeah. You didn't want a little unplanned underwater photography.
No, that would not have been great. Yeah. It took a lot of strategy to figure out how we were going to do it. And I think too, like, we wanted it to look like a beautiful film. You know, we didn't want it to necessarily just be straightforward. We're going to capture what we're going to capture. We went into it with intentionality that we wanted it to almost feel poetic in its visuals. And I think we achieved that, which I'm very happy about. So.
I agree. I think you did. And, you know, I wanted to go back on something you just said, and that was, I know a lot of filmmakers who do what you did, which is also take a still film camera.
Mm-hmm.
And does that actually help you between the two mediums to kind of focus, even though those stills don't necessarily make it into the film? But does it help your eye? Does it help you to see things? Or did you see things in the video that make you want to do that, or vice versa?
Yeah, I think it does help me. You know, I started my first visual art form that I loved to dabble in was still photography. It was digital still photography, but when I was in middle school, early high school, that's like what I gravitated towards. And then I fell into a video class and the rest is history. But that was kind of originally how I saw the world, you know, was through, and how I loved to capture the world was through still photography. So I think I'm not a DP, I'm not a cinematographer. I think it's important that we kind of differentiate these roles out in our field and have these specialties and trust people that are really good at those things, you know, which is what I had with Evelyn, which I'm so grateful about. But I think it did help me because it kind of helped me see the setup in a very particular way, and then say like, how can we transfer these to video? Even if I, you know, because I didn't get the stills back until later, but I was still looking through the lens. I was looking for opportunities to shoot things, and so then I was able to say, I just got the shot. I think it's going to be good. Like, can you try and like emulate this? Like, what can we get in video form? So it does help me, I think. And I've only really started doing film photography again in the last couple of years, but I really love it, and I do think aesthetically we're kind of reaching for that in a lot of film right now, like that kind of feeling, the grit, the authenticity, the groundedness, versus the hyper realism, and so I liked leaning back into that with this film.
Yeah, I love that. I probably shoot film a little less frequently than you are. I usually have my digital still with me too on shoots. And I feel like it's almost like journaling while you're there too. And for me, it helps me to process really important moments and story points and things like that. And so I think that I always look back and I think, wow, you know, this part in the film might not have been there had I not been in the right frame of mind. And I think you're right. I think that's why a lot of people, folks who aren't making a film necessarily are gravitating toward analog film because of the amount of time and attention. And like you said, like a little bit more deliberate, action taken to like get a roll of 24 or whatever, stills out of a camera.
Yeah. You can't just really cool. go 20 on your cell phone right now. You know, you have to think about the light. You really have to think about subject and, you know, how you're going to frame it. So yeah, I think it does help.
Yeah. And I think that you're both talking about is this idea that you have a frame right on video or with film, it's not quite the same. There's something about that frame, right, of looking through that lens on your DSLR or whatever you have on your regular analog camera. But when you're looking at that, you're actually framing an image, which I think is part of what you were saying, Rocky, is part of setting yourself kind of these benchmarks that I'd like to arrive here in the film, or I'd like to start here in a film. Mm-hmm. Is that right? I mean, is that part of it?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's moments, right? Like that's what a still image is it's the moments, right? And in a film, like with netmakers, you know, there are moments, they play out, but like to Hannah's point earlier, she was saying, you know, there's a lot of moments that didn't make it in the film. And so I even find like, that's kind of what you're doing when you shoot a roll of film, but you're self-editing. Mm-hmm. You're saying, I mean, I had a film, I did shoot a roll in San Diego a couple of weeks ago. Our family was on vacation and I did take one roll of film. And I found myself, that happened a lot. My kids would say, did you get it, Dad? And I would say, sometimes I would say, you know what? I tried from two or three different angles and I didn't like them. And it wasn't, the moment wasn't there. So I didn't snap the photo. Yeah. And that's okay. Right. And I think that's really important for filmmaking, because you're right. You know, Hannah, you were able to go ahead and cut an hour of exactly how to, you know, the technicalities of how to do the hoop nets. But a lot of filmmakers, I think, struggle sometimes with coming back with hours and hours and hours of footage and then struggling to figure out where the story actually is. Mm-hmm. And so I think something else you said that was super smart and that I think you just nailed was sort of having this deliberate approach that you kind of knew what you wanted it to feel like, and it sort of has like that poetic feel, and knowing that you went into that deliberately doesn't, you know, surprise me at all, because I think it's hard to tease that out of what essentially is the equivalent of just snapping a million pictures on your iPhone. Well, we all know, like, if we're all being honest with ourselves, we don't do much with most of those.
No,
yeah. They're just there, you know. And so yeah, having that like deliberate sense of attention and focus is so important.
Well, and I wanted it to feel artistic, because, and I experienced this a lot with attending in-person screenings, not the Indiana Humanities screenings necessarily, but just festival screenings. So just like a general audience, right, who might even be there to see a different film in the lineup, but they're also seeing my film. And afterward, I heard a lot of like, man, when I like read the synopsis for this, I was like, I'm not interested in this, or like, I don't anticipate caring about these, you know, subjects. And then at the end of it, they're like, wow, I feel really emotionally invested in what these men are doing in their lives and their livelihoods. And I knew that, you know, on the surface level, two sort of Southern gruff, you know, men, you know, might not be appealing to a wide audience. But I said, you know, if we really show how beautiful their story is and how beautiful it is what, you know, what they do, then people will get emotionally invested in it. And that's like what I try and do with everything that I create, is build this, you know, bridge of empathy. And so, yeah, I think without that deliberate conversation with myself and then with my DP of like how we wanted it to look and feel beforehand, that maybe we wouldn't have had as much success with building connection like we did.
Anna, this is just that idea of building that intentionality of conversation. You know, I think that is so powerful and a part of what it is. We've been talking with our guests, Hannah Myers Lindgren and Rocky Walls, about a new film called The Netmakers, which is streaming on WhoDocs. And we'll make sure when we come back that we get a URL for you to be able to go as see this film. And so please join us for more conversation after a short break.
No alarm clock. No traffic to negotiate. No staff meetings to attend. Sunday is your day, so do yourself a favor. Tune out all that noise and tune in for Sunday Baroque.
Sunday morning from 5 to 9 here on 88.7 WICR.
Welcome back. I'm Mark Kiesling. Today we're having a conversation with our guests, Hannah Myers Lindgren and Rocky Walls, about their new film, The Netmakers. The film centers on a whole lot of things: the water, invasive species, climate change, shifting dynamics of commercial fishing, and all these great characters, including Annette. But I wanted to start us back in here looking at, this was part of the whole waterways initiative to look at that. And I think a lot of our listeners don't know, especially the ones that are outside Indiana, but even I think in central Indiana and northern, they don't know how that area is. So you've got a White River, which is, again, totally contained in the state of Indiana. It doesn't actually cross any state borders. And it flows down and flows into the Wabash. Mm-hmm. That southern part of Indiana, right before you were filming. And then the Wabash, you know, then all flows into Ohio and eventually all this to the Mississippi and the Gulf, right? And yeah. So people forget about this idea of watershed. So you're at the confluence of a lot of things. And as you get towards Evansville, as you get down to where you were, you've got the Ohio, you've got the Wabash, and you've got the White, all in that area. So water is essential for life there, and life evolved like you had hinted at. So how did you tell the story of the water?
Yeah, we didn't touch, I mean, in the film, we didn't touch a lot on sort of the impact, you know, that what we do to our waterways has on, say, yeah, the Gulf or anything like that. I think I know that kind of from previous stuff I've done related to waterways and about the White River up here in Indianapolis. But really, I just tried to focus on the waterways in terms of how intrinsically connected they were to Larry and Danny's lives. And they're not the only ones who live down there, you know, whose lives are connected to these rivers. I mean, even in like when we were shooting with Larry, you know, we were filming and you can see like this power plant, you know, behind him that's along the river that, you know, is related to the waterways. So yeah, I don't know. I tried to focus on their relationship with it. One of my favorite parts of the film is like when Larry talks about how when he was a kid, his dad would take him and taught him how to swim and taught him about the river by just sort of putting him in there, holding his hands and letting him feel the currents and letting him feel what it feels here versus how it feels differently over here. And these guys know the water so well. It's crazy. I mean, they can look at what we just see as sort of this giant brown river and it just looks like one sort of massive, you know, section of water. They know just by looking at the top of the water what's going on the bottom. You know, they know how deep it is, they know the temperature, they know what kinds of plants or rocks or other things might, you know, what environment is down there for which types of fish. And so I think that was kind of the main focus, is like their relationship with the water and like how they see the water. They have a very intimate connection with it, and an intimate connection with how it's doing, you know, whether it's high or low based on the rainfall, you know, whether there are more fish or less fish, whether it's polluted or not, whether the riverbanks are changing or not. And they know everything about it. I think, you know, it's easy to think that only like, I don't know, maybe left-leaning climate change scientists are like paying attention to what's going on the riverbanks and what's going on with invasive species and other climate impacts. That's not true. I mean, these guys know it more than anyone, you know, because they're living it and they're touching that water every day and they're interacting with it every day. And they have for 50 plus years. So yeah, I wanted to just give them the opportunity to talk about what they've seen, without kind of putting my stamp on it or making some sort of political statement about what's going on with our waterways. You know, and so that's where you kind of get these stories of them talking about what's happening with the riverbanks, what's happening, you know, with the invasive species and from Lake Michigan and are coming out and how it's decimating, you know, the populations. Yeah, so that's really what I tried to focus on, is more their like seeing the waterways through their lens instead of necessarily like bigger picture.
Yeah, and that really comes through in the film. And the power here is you are making a statement, but you're not making it in the way that is just data or fact driven.
And I'm not making it. They are.
Yeah. And but it is interesting because I think more of that approach is going to be needed, because people can write off just that, oh, it's bad this way, or it also can be intellectualized. These people are making their living off it, right? This is commercial fishing.
Yes.
So this is what's even more incredible, is that it's not just that they're fishing for pleasure, but they're commercially doing it. And everything that goes in that water is affecting their lives. And they'll tell you about it, and did.
Yeah, exactly. 100%. I agree with you. It's really easy to just sort of hear what's going on with our waterways and with our climate and just sort of brush it away because it seems too big and it also seems impersonal. But when you hear from these gentlemen and, you know, you see the way that they interact with the water, you definitely understand that it has an impact on an individual level. And it's much easier to care about wanting to do something about it if you see that, you know, these men are struggling with certain elements, than if you don't. And most of us don't know people, right, who work on the river, whose livelihoods are wrapped up in the river, because that is sort of something you think about happened, you know, 100 years ago or something, is more of that lifestyle. But it's still relevant today to a lot of people.
Wow.
And it's, I often think of the quote, and I think it gets attributed to Mr. Rogers, although I don't know if anyone knows if he really said it or not, but I think it goes something like, it's impossible not to love someone when you really hear their story. Mm-hmm. And I think you touched on that earlier, but I do think, and you do a great job with that in your other works as well, where I think hearing from an individual and letting them show and tell you why they matter and why what they believe in and why what they're passionate matters. It's kind of hard to argue with that, you know. Yeah. It's like, what am I going to do? Say they're not relevant. They don't matter. Well, they do, you know. Yeah. And when you hear their story and when you see their passion, you realize that does matter. That is important. And so I think that's just a really special way to tell stories.
It makes me emotional, like tearing up. Yeah, because that's, you know, the whole reason why I got into this field, and why I knew I wanted to do documentary film, is because one of the first video projects I did in a high school video class was about my grandfather. And I loved him to death. He was such like a teddy bear, but on the outside, I mean, he was military man, very non-emotional, sort of kept everything close, man. And I, you know, did this interview with him. He was a three-war veteran, World War II, Korea, and Vietnam. And he, you know, medals and everything. Who knows what he saw in his life, you know? And I just did this little video about him, very rudimentary for my skill level at the time. And when I played it back for my family and for him, he got emotional. So, and then my family got emotional. And then my teacher in my class got emotional. And it like clicked then that like, not only is it powerful as an audience to step into someone's shoes and to see their story, but it's also powerful to have your story told and have to be given the platform and to be, you know, to share what your life's experience has been. And so that is kind of just set me on this path, even, and you can kind of, I can see that through line up until, you know, now with the Net Makers. Of that's always what I try to do. You know, we can never have too much empathy, you know, or compassion or connection in the world. So I love our medium in particular for doing that, because I think video and film is just so unique. I mean, even more so than still photos. I mean, you can really feel immersed and emotionally connected to a story in a way that you can't with many other mediums.
Yeah, we, years ago in the Children's Museum, when I was there, we designed a set of exhibits that what we were trying to do is just use up some objects that we had in the collection that didn't hold together with a bigger theme, right? And one of the areas, and there were individual rooms that we set up. So they were behind glass, and you would think non-interactive, but they were. But one of them was a Vietnam vet's room that he returned home to. Mm. It had the clothing and certain things around, and it was a place that we found through our studies that people came to do what you're just saying. They came and told their story, and they needed that framework.
Yeah.
Do it. So what you're presenting is also that framework. You're presenting to your grandfather the framework in which he can tell something, right? Yeah. And then it somehow is in, what's powerful about your film is then it's recorded, right? And it can be retold.
Yeah.
And so even though, so I hear a film in the making here with this particular subject?
Yeah. So, you know, that when I recorded with my grandfather was way back in the day. It was not great quality. but a few years ago, a couple years before he passed away, my mom and I sat down and got about 3 hours worth of interview with him on camera, about his life and about his experience, you know, in the military and all the other things he did in his life. And, it's definitely, I've you know, had the transcripts, I've been working on them. It's like something that's bouncing around in my head, but you know, he passed away when we were filming The Net Makers. So it wasn't that long ago. I mean, it was 2 years ago, you know? And I find it still difficult to be in that, you know, hearing him and working with his story for too long. At the same time, it feels very good to, you know, it's to connect to our ancestors and the people who you know, they're the only reason we're here, is important. So yeah, I want to create something out of it. And I think his story is really compelling, but we'll see. We'll see what happens.
Yeah, that, thank you for sharing that, your emotions about that with us. And I know how hard that could be. Rocky, you really, you just are amazing that you can find these people that are filmmakers around the state. And
Hannah makes herself easy to find, though. So don't give me any credit for that. She certainly didn't on this project or any of her others need any help from me. I think I'm fortunate that I'm able to watch and see filmmakers produce work like The Net Makers, and you know, Hannah, being able to say to you like, hey, what's coming up, what's next, and knowing that you're determined to make something else, and also knowing you well enough to know that it's probably going to be something or multiple things in the coming years that do this work of telling Hoosier stories, telling stories that make us reflect and be proud to be Hoosiers, or sometimes be challenged as a Hoosier. And I just think that's so special. And you know, Mark, I appreciate your compliments. I think launching Hoodocs, where you can watch The Net Makers along with dozens and dozens of other Indiana-based films from Indiana filmmakers, I think that's the heart of it all, right? To take a lot of what Hannah has described here and what she's done with Net Makers and some of her other work, and give us as Hoosiers and then beyond, people who are outside of Indiana, something to look at and be really proud of. You know, and so you can find all of that and more at hoodox.tv, HOODOX. It's for Hoosier Documentaries, hoodox.tv. And we do a subscription-based model where you can subscribe and know that your any dollar that you put toward Hoodox, whether it's for your subscription or a donation or whatever, is going to a 501c3 organization here in Indiana, where we take half or more of every dollar that the organization makes and kick it right back to filmmakers in the way of licensing fees and in the future, hopefully funding opportunities and ways to just continue to kind of build this mass of good storytelling and keep it snowballing, because I just think there's so much room for us to be proud and be happy about the stories and again be challenged. I never want to leave that one out. Be challenged sometimes here in Indiana, and so yeah, that's where you can find it. Hoodox.tv. The Net Makers are on, it's on there now. I think there's a couple of behind the scenes interviews with Hannah from some time we spent at the Can Can Cinema in downtown Indianapolis. And those are fun to watch as well. You know, think of it like your own little personal Indiana Netflix, you know, where we've got a lot of really great documentaries and we've got a lot of great filmmakers. Like Hannah and others who have shared their work and shared their passion and by extension shared the passion of others that they spend time with. So that's where you can find that.
Thank you so much for sharing all those. And yes, please go and look that up at hoodox.tv. And you're just going to be wonderful. I love, that's how I found this. So I love finding new films and artists on there. Just a reminder that the Da Vinci Pursuit brings together artists and scientists and members of the community to engage in conversations that explore the intersections of art and science. And we encourage you to at home to have conversations with family and other people about what you're hearing today and be inspired by it. And we'll be right back.
Hello, Indiana. This is Dr. Laura Merrifield Wilson, host of Positively Politics. I'd like to invite you to join our conversation on the current issues and events in politics with the experts who know them best. Every Saturday morning here on WICR at 11:30, we break down the sometimes negative and often complicated world of politics in a nonpartisan, straightforward, and educationally rooted way. You won't want to miss the discussion on Positively Politics Saturday morning at 11:30 right here on The Diamond.
Welcome back. We're having a conversation with Hannah Myers Lindgren and Rocky Walls about a new film, The Netmakers, that's streaming on WhoDocs. And I want to talk in general about filmmaking and why local filmmaking. You know, we talk about local food movements and we talk about buying local. Why is it important to also think about supporting local artists that are filmmakers?
You take it away, Rocky. That one's more of a
question. I mean, I think I can summarize that by just piggybacking off of what you said, Mark. You know, we talk about supporting local, buying local, and I think it's really it's becoming more and more mainstream, but hopefully not from like a fad perspective or a trend perspective. I think that people genuinely are starting to understand, and I think we have kind of want to not think about the pandemic and a lot of the long-term effects of that. I think one of the positives that we got out of that time period was understanding the value of local. You know, we had a lot, we had to think about our restaurants and think about them probably in a way that we hadn't before. And we kind of realized we probably spent a lot of time, many, many years taking them for granted. Taking for granted our service industries and the supply chains, that have been struck so hard and we're still feeling lingering effects of that. And so for me, I know personally, and then I've talked to a lot of other people who feel the same way. I was able to focus on like, oh, wow. Like now that I really stop to think about it, like when I buy something local, when I shop somewhere locally owned, or when I, even more so when I buy a product, whether it's my food or a gift, a handmade item or something like that locally, it has a great impact. It has an impact on the people who are receiving that money. It has an impact on their employees, and then in turn the entire local economy. I do think that it's a little more challenging to translate that over to our how we spend our time with what we consume from a media perspective, and part of that, as I did research for launching WhoDocs, part of that is that people, I think, just by and large don't know that these kinds of things exist. Like it's just hard to recognize and realize that, which is why we launched WhoDocs, to help put them in the spotlight as more and more as we can. And so I think when you consider, as a Hoosier, oftentimes we have like this Hoosier hospitality, Hoosier humility. Like we kind of oftentimes we think of ourselves maybe less. I don't know. We don't have the mountains. We don't have the beach. We always think about what we don't have. And I think what documentary film can do, especially character focus or place centric documentary, like what we've been talking about today, what it can do is it can really help you to realize what we do have, and it can emphasize the value of those things. And so I think for me, encouraging people to watch local as well, you know, we kind of have, that's a WhoDocs tagline, you shop local, you eat local, it's time to watch local, has that value. It has the value, the ability to connect you to people, places, and things that should be really important to you. The bottom line is what happens right in your own neighborhood with your own local politics, with your own local economy, probably is going to have more of an effect on you than anything else. And so while we can get on Facebook or we can get on social media and we can talk about saving the other side of the planet, and we can and we should, I don't mean to knock that, we ought to talk about what we can do right here, too. And I think that's what documentary film, especially in Indiana, can do. I think one of the other challenges that we found, right, there were kind of like two big challenges when we were researching what to do and how to launch Who Docs. And one of them was this idea that Hoosiers, people in Indiana who would be the viewers, the consumers of local content, didn't know that it was there, right? There's like this chasm. There's like people over here who maybe would watch it if they knew it was available, but they didn't know how to get there. And there's, you know, there's two sides to that chasm. And I think the other side is the filmmakers. You've got really passionate people who want to tell incredible stories, who know, like Hannah knew, you know, when she met, probably, I don't know how long it took, probably not very long, meeting with these guys in their nets, before you realized that people were going to love them. People were going to appreciate them. But then what do you do with it? You get it out there and you show it at some film festivals, or, you know, Hannah was fortunate enough to be partnering with Indiana Humanities, where they took it on a tour of the state. A lot of other filmmakers don't even have that. They just put it online and hope that people watch it. So I think what we have to address is the other side of that chasm too. How can filmmakers, continue to be empowered and encouraged and raise funds and have the time and the resources to do this good work? And so I think, you know, I'll stop there and ask, you know, Hannah to maybe talk about being a Hoosier filmmaker. You're an Indiana native. You've grown up here. You've got a history with promoting Indiana, even with your family, you know, kind of promoting Indiana. What is it about being a Hoosier filmmaker that's, you know, maybe both rewarding, but especially like challenging, right? Because I know you would do this every hour of your waking day, if you could, and you're doing it a lot, but there are challenges that come with it too. So maybe talk us through some of that.
Yeah. I love our state. I mean, I've lived in a lot of different places, and my general feeling is that no place is perfect. Every place has its flaws, even if it's a place that is, you know, lauded and put up on this pedestal, like some of our bigger cities. I think we have so much going for us here in this state. Rocky alluded to, my mother's worked in tourism for most of her career and worked in tourism for the state. So I was lucky at a young age to see a lot of this state. And we have so much diversity of place, so much diversity of people, so much diversity of stories that I think we don't get the credit for. And especially in our mainstream media, we're chalked up to be this one thing when that's just not the case. We have a really, really rich history, and a really rich history that's important to our country's history. And I think we often don't get that credit. So that's why I love making stories here and telling our stories. I think they're incredibly important and can bridge that empathy gap and that connection gap. But the struggle is finances, you know? And I think it's hard because while filmmaking is an art, it's an art form, it's often seen as not that. It's often seen as just a media thing or something that is not the same as a painting or, you know, a piece of music or things like that. But unlike, you know, a painting where, ooh, you go and you see it and you love it and then you purchase it and then you feel good about supporting that local artist, you're having to basically put your money behind something that is unseen, you know? And so that, I think, is one of the barriers when it comes to our art form. We're lucky to have organizations, you know, like Indiana Humanities, who are starting to change that and provide opportunities. And I wish that other organizations in other areas of our culture, because, you know, Indiana Humanities, they want things about humanities, which is wonderful and it's so important. And it is pretty broad in itself. But yeah, let's see other organizations that, you know, are different from that, putting money behind telling, you know, authentic Indiana stories. I think the other, you know, thing that Rocky mentioned is it is hard, distribution is hard, you know, and having a place for it to land. Because once you do your festival run, it's like, okay, well, now what, you know? And Rocky and Who Docs has really changed the game with that, you know? It's given us a place to land. I knew when I got to a certain point with the Netmakers that I wanted to put it on Who Docs, because that is a place where it's going to get seen by so many more people that, you know, I wouldn't have been able to get it in front of if I just put it on YouTube or something, you know? And also, you know, they do give, you know, a licensing fee, you know, which, you know, it's not $1 million, but it helps. And it's showing that our work is valued and all that time and energy that we put into something is valued. So I'm so grateful for HUDOCS and what they do for Indiana filmmakers.
I'm really impressed by what both of you are saying, because what I think is so powerful is that you are doing something that you're not only passionate about, but you're also putting yourself out there and taking the risks to do that. And the risks are high because this is not free. You know, what are you supposed to do with your time and all that? And yet I feel that's what real art is about. One thing I wanted to talk briefly about was that you mentioned the role of media in general. And I think what's really hard for any local, but particularly in Indiana, is how you, media and filmmakers portray Indiana outside of Indiana.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's backwoods or it's always something, you know, and it's
the sort butt of the joke.
Right. It's always something like that. And yet, when you have a local filmmaker like yourself and you engage in that, you're going from your love of something and the truth about what's really there rather than the other. And I think you're fighting that all the time. Is that part of the reason that motivates you as well?
100%. Yeah. I mean, because, you know, I don't know. It just, it's so special getting to tell our stories as a Hoosier, you know, not even just somebody coming in from outside and telling the story. I think we have a lot to offer in terms of things that people would want to watch, stories people would want to, you know, hear. And just look at what's available on HUDOCS. I mean, it's all over the map. I mean, there's so many different topics and, you know, types of people and types of places. It's really a great representation of what our state actually looks like. And as more films go on there, I'm sure it'll continue to reflect that.
That's like the beauty of it too, is like, you know, like you were saying, Mark, that, you know, we kind of want to counteract or sort of prove that the Indiana isn't just a flyover state or it's not like, you know, you said like the butt of a joke or whatever. But the funny thing is, a lot of times when you set out to prove something, it's hard because there might be some truth in it. Right. And so you have to like really turn over like every rock, and yeah, then you finally find something and you're like, all right, now this is like the, you know, I'm ready to storm the hill or whatever. It's not hard at all. Like I'm sure like I can confidently say it. Hannah, I'm sure, can confidently say it. You line up any other Indiana filmmaker, they would probably confidently say it. Like, we have more ideas for incredible stories than we can produce. Like, so it's not that's not the issue. It's not that Indiana isn't awesome. The people in Indiana aren't awesome. It's not that. It's that we just, you know, we need more resources and we need more people to consume it. Right. We don't want to just make it just because Indiana is awesome or this particular story is awesome. We want to make it and we want people to enjoy it and be changed by it. And so, yeah, I definitely agree.
I think that's really, Rocky, both what you're saying and then Hannah, the idea of being, you know, the funding is so critical. And I would hope that anybody listening to this and our listeners will support the local artists through HUDOCS, through that mission, but also by actually listening to and watching these pieces, right? That changes you. And then your word of mouth and mentioning that, oh, you just saw this and you saw it on HUDOCS, is probably, we can't pay for that. And so I feel really strongly that about local place, but also our funding. And you know, it is critical that we change our funding model somehow, and that we start looking at the, you know, the real independent artists that are out there. It's so easy for us to fund something big. I love that you're doing this.
And I think we can empower your listeners and the Indiana public in general, that, you know, that funding for a film like The Netmakers is nothing probably like what you think it is, actually, you know, like not to minimalize it, you know, but Hannah, you described it yourself as like fairly low budget, you know, right. And that's not to say that everything should be or needs to be, but, you know, just to make absolutely sure that everybody knows, that Hoosiers know you can actively participate in the local film industry in Indiana. It's not something that gets done, you know, far off with you know, millions of dollars and things that probably are out of reach for you. You can participate in it. You could probably reach out to Hannah or to me or to Mark and have a conversation about filmmaking or film consuming if it's something that's interesting to you. And your $10 or your $100 or your $100,000 or whatever, it can really have a huge impact on Indiana filmmaking. And I'll say one last thing about that. I always like to remind people that I firmly believe that storytellers are what make the world go round, right? You know, people don't get elected to office without storytellers. You know, big corporations don't move into town and create jobs without storytellers. Somewhere along the line, somebody's telling a story. Hopefully it's true, but somebody's telling a story. And that's what I think Indiana can invest in. We can invest in the stories that we have here and do an even better job in the coming years of amplifying voices, celebrating voices and stories in Indiana, and everybody can participate in that.
Thank you both Hannah and Rocky for spending time with us today. And until next time, I'm Mark Kiesling, reminding you to tune in again when we explore more curiosities from the intersections of art and science.
You've been listening to Intersections, where art and science meet, with your host, Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, and Krista Hoffman Longton, Assistant Dean for Faculty Affairs and Professional Development at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Just a reminder, the Da Vinci Pursuit brings together artists, scientists, and members of the community to engage in conversation that explore the intersections between art and science. We encourage you to explore further in conversation with others. Any of the ideas explored in today's show at www.thedaVinciPursuit.com.